Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 1 Kings chapter 9. I'm going to do the entire chapter in this audio. I'll call it The Lord Answers Solomon's Prayer. And we'll also look at some other miscellaneous activities of Solomon. Our context is this. In our last chapter, Solomon has given a prayer of dedication at the dedication of the temple that he had just built, and he had given a solemn benediction to the people and dismissed them. And so that's our context. So we begin here in 1 Kings 9. We'll start with verse 1. When Solomon had finished building the temple of the Lord in the royal palace and had achieved all he had desired to do, verse 2, the Lord appeared to him a second time as he had appeared to him at Gibeon. Well, the appearance here is the night after the dedication of the temple. This is a second time because the Lord had appeared to Solomon at Gibeon a previous time, and that was recorded at 1 Kings 3, verses 4 through 5. The king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there because it was the most famous high place. He offered 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream at night. God said, "Ask, what should I give you?" And if you recall, Solomon asked for wisdom in how to govern the people instead of fame and fortune, and God honored him for that. Now, that first appearance to Solomon at Gibeon is said in verse 5, 1 Kings 3, to be in a dream at night. So when we return to our verse here in 1 Kings 9, verse 2, the Lord appeared to Solomon a second time as he had appeared to him at Gibeon. We assume that that means it's another dream at night that God appears to Solomon. Now, how he looked, I don't know. Maybe just dazzling light. Maybe like to the prophet seated upon a throne over a golden or a sea of sapphire. Our parallel passage in 2 Chronicles 7, 11 through 12 says this, "So Solomon finished the Lord's temple and the royal palace. Everything that had entered Solomon's heart to do for the Lord's temple and for his own palace succeeded. Then the Lord appeared to Solomon at night and said to him, 'I have heard your prayer and have chosen this place for myself as a temple of sacrifice.'" Well, here the parallel passage in 2 Chronicles 7 says that the Lord appeared to Solomon at night, and since it was like God had appeared to Solomon at Gibeon earlier, which was also at night in a dream, you put all that together, and we can assume here that Solomon's dreaming again the night after the dedication of the temple, and God appears to him. Now, what I'm going to do, I'm going to read verses 3 through 9 in sections, and I'm going to show you how God is answering every prayer that Solomon had made in chapter 8 at the dedication of the temple. In other words, he only had to wait one night, and all of his prayers were answered. So let's read first 1 Kings 8:29, and I'll show you how 1 Kings 9:3 answers that prayer. 1 Kings 8:29, Solomon's prayer at the Feast of Dedication. "So that your eyes may watch over this temple, may your eyes watch over this temple night and day towards the place where you said," Solomon is talking to God, "where you, Yahweh, said, 'My name will be there,' and so that you, Yahweh, may hear the prayer that your servant prays towards this place." So Solomon asked the night before at the feast after the dedication of the temple that God would watch over the temple day and night, that his name would be there, and that God would hear his prayer. Well, let's read verse 3 of 1 Kings 9. "The Lord said to him," said to Solomon, "I have heard the prayer and plea you have made before me. I have consecrated this temple, which you have built, by putting my name there forever. My eyes and my heart will always be there." Well, that's a direct answer to prayer. His name's going to be put there. "My eyes and my heart will always be there." Solomon prayed that your eyes may watch over this temple night and day. "My eyes and my heart will always be there." That directly answers that. All right, well, let's see what Solomon prayed in 1 Kings 8, 25 through 26, the previous day at the temple dedication. 1 Kings 8, 25 through 26. "Therefore, Lord God of Israel, keep what you promised to your servant, my father David. You will never fail to have a man to sit before me on the throne of Israel," as Solomon quotes Nathan's prophecy to David. "You will never fail to have a man to sit before me on the throne of Israel if only your sons guard their walk before me as you have walked before me. Now, Lord God of Israel, please confirm what you promised to your servant, my father David." So Solomon is asking that God will confirm that there will always be a man sitting on the throne of David. So we go now to 1 Kings chapter 9, where we are now, verses 4 and 5. This is Solomon quoting the Lord, or this is actually the text saying what the Lord had was telling Solomon in this dream at night. As for you, if you walk before me in integrity of heart and uprightness, as David your father did, and do all I command and observe my decrees and laws, I will establish your royal throne over Israel forever, as I promised David your father when I said, you shall never fail to have a man on the throne of Israel. That's a direct answer to prayer. He prayed, I don't want a man to fail on the throne of Israel. And then God says, you will not have a man fail on the throne of Israel. Now, of course, this was implied to be conditional. The throne eventually failed Zedekiah at the time of the Babylonian captivity because of the Israelites' horrible sin. But that didn't happen during Solomon's time. He didn't see that. Now, verses 33 through 46 in 1 Kings 8 gives us a further prayer of Solomon that Solomon prayed at the dedication of the temple. I'll read that first. When your people Israel are defeated before an enemy, Solomon prays because they have sinned against you, and they return to you and praise your name, and they pray and plead with you for mercy in this temple. May you hear in heaven and forgive the sin of your people Israel. Okay, the first thing he prays for is forgive the people when they sin and get defeated. May you restore them to the land you gave their ancestors when the skies are shut and there is no rain, because they have sinned against you, and they pray toward this place and praise your name, and they turn from their sins because you were afflicting them. May you hear in heaven and forgive the sin of your servants and your people Israel, so that you may teach them the good way they should walk in. Basically saying, forgive the people of Israel when they sin. May you send rain on your land that you gave your people for an inheritance. When there is famine on the earth, when there is pestilence, when there is blight, mildew, locust, or grasshopper, when their enemy besieges them in the region of their fortified cities, when there is any plague or illness, whatever prayer or petition anyone from your people Israel might have, each man knowing his own afflictions and spreading out his hands toward this temple, may you hear in heaven. In other words, take away all plagues from us. Forgive, act, and repay the man according to all his ways. In other words, repay the enemy that's besieging Israel. I could go on, but that's the general thrust of the prayer in chapter 8. And so I'm going to stop there. Well, let's go to 1 Kings 9 and see how that prayer is answered. 1 Kings 9, verses 6 through 9. Again, this is in the dream that God is speaking to Solomon the next day after the temple dedication. Starting with verse 6. But if you or your sons turn away from me and do not observe the commands and decrees I have given you and go off to serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land I have given them, and I will reject this temple I have consecrated for my name. There's your condition. Israel will then become a byword and an object of ridicule among all the peoples. And though this temple is now imposing, all who pass by will be appalled and will scoff and say, why has the Lord done such a thing to this land and to this temple? People will answer, because they have forsaken the Lord their God, who brought their fathers out of Egypt and have embraced other gods, worshiping and serving them. That is why the Lord brought all this disaster on them. Now, what God is doing here is answering Solomon when he says, when the people of Israel, please turn them back. And God says, well, the reason they got beat is because of their sin. Now, let's pick up a few more details from these first nine verses. In verse 3, God tells Solomon in the dream, I have consecrated this temple. How did God consecrate the temple in the previous chapter, chapter 8? Well, the Shekinah glory appeared in the Holy of Holies and in the holy place and just everywhere. Courtyard 2, the fire consumed the burnt offerings that were put on the altar. That's how God consecrated the temple. In verse 4, in the dream, God tells Solomon, if you will walk before me in integrity of heart and uprightness, as David your father did. And of course, we immediately ask, well, did he murder somebody? Didn't he murder the husband of the wife, Bathsheba? Didn't he murder Uriah the Hittite, who was married to Bathsheba, who David had illicit sex with? Well, whenever it talks about how God was a man after God's own heart, it's talking about he didn't go after idols, which was the big deal back then. I mean, God was upset with the murder and the adultery too, but this is referring to God is referring to the fact he's not committing idolatry, which of course was what Solomon's going to end up doing. That shows how important refraining from idolatry was to God. I mean, adultery and murder is bad, but idolatry is real bad too, and we don't quite look at it that way because we do not give God the honor that is due him. Now, verses 6 through 9, which I just read, starts out with this phrase, but if you or your sons turn away from me and do not observe the commands, One of my commentators says that the record of this second vision, in which were rehearsed the conditions of God's covenant with Solomon and the consequences of breaking them, is inserted here as a proper introduction to the narrative about to be given of this king's commercial enterprises and ambitious desire for worldly glory. For this king, by an encouraging an influx of foreign people and a taste for foreign luxuries, rapidly corrupted his own mind and that of his subjects, so that they turned from following God, they and their children. And so Solomon keeps talking about in his prayer the day before about, please God, when your people ask forgiveness and come back. Well, they didn't really do that too much now, did they? God promises that they're going to get cut off in verse 7 for all their sins. Well, that's exactly what happened in 722 B.C. The northern 10 tribes were cut off by the Assyrians. And in 586 B.C., the southern 2 tribes, Judah and Benjamin, were sent off to exile and destroyed in 586 B.C. by Nebuchadnezzar II, the Babylonian captivity. So now we turn to 1 Kings 9, verses 10 through 14. At the end of 20 years, during which Solomon built these two buildings, the temple of the Lord and the royal palace, King Solomon gave 20 towns in Galilee to Hiram, king of Tyre, because Hiram had supplied him with all the cedar and pine and gold he wanted. But when Hiram went from Tyre to see the towns that Solomon had given him, he was not pleased with them. What kind of towns are these you have given me, my brother? He asked, and he called them the land of Kabul, a name they have to this day. Now Hiram had sent to the king 120 talents of gold. Now verse 10, at the end of 20 years, refers to the roughly seven years it took to build the temple and roughly 13 years it took to build the royal palace. More precisely, it's 7.5 years to build the temple and probably 12.5 years to build the palace. How do we know 7.5 years to build the temple? We go to 1 Kings 6:38. In his and Solomon's 11th year in the 8th month, in the month of Bull, the temple was completed in every detail. That's the 11th year of Solomon's reign, but it took him 4 years to get started with the foundation. So at the end of verse 38, 1 Kings 6, so he built it in 7 years. But that 7 years is a round number because you can look at the start date in the second month of Ziv and the finish date in the 8th month of Bull. That's an extra 6 months. So it's 7.5 years. We talked about that in a previous podcast. And so in 1 Kings 7:1, Solomon completed his entire complex after 13 years of construction. That's probably a round number for 12.5. Or either the number here, 20, is 20.5 and it's rounded. But roughly 20 years to build, that's a long time, folks. 20 years to build his great temple and his great palace. Notice his palace took longer and was bigger than God's palace. A lot of people made a lot of comment about that, as Solomon was a glory hog. Now in verse 11, Solomon gave 20 towns in Galilee to Hiram of Tyre. Now what it sounds like is he just basically sold the towns for the cedar and pine and gold that he used in the temple. But then we have this curious phrase in verse 12, Hiram went to see the towns that Solomon had given him and was not pleased with them. He called them the land of Kabul, which means good for nothing. It's a great name for a region. The name stuck. Well, we're going to have to speculate a little bit about what's happening here. First of all, these towns, were they outside of Israel? Well, they must have been, because Solomon couldn't give away territory allotted to the 12 tribes. So these towns in the north, in Galilee, which is in the northern region, those towns might be cities which David had conquered and taken out of the hands of the ancient inhabitants of those towns. And, of course, Solomon would have inherited those towns from his father David, and so Solomon had a right to dispose of them. Now, these towns, again, were not inhabited by Israelites. We know that by reading 2 Chronicles 8:2. Solomon had rebuilt the cities Hiram gave him and settled Israelites there. So at some point, these cities, Solomon had put Israelites there, which means they weren't Israelites there before. And so we can speculate from that these cities were outside the tribe of Israel. So that's not a problem. But we do have a problem with that verse I just quoted, 2 Chronicles 8:2. Solomon rebuilt the cities Hiram gave him, but in 1 Kings 9:11, our verse that we're working on now, Solomon gave the cities to Hiram. So how do we explain that? Well, here's a couple of options to solve that. Hiram gave those cities back to Solomon after the debt of the 120 talents of gold was paid. Well, the debt of the gold and the cedar and the pine or the cypress, the wood and the gold. So the idea here is that Solomon borrowed the money from Hiram, gave the 20 cities to Hiram as security for the loan. Hiram said, that's fine, I'll take it, sight unseen. And then when he went to look at his security, he says, brother, this is not worth all the gold and cypress and cedar I sent to you. But then Solomon repaid the debt, and Hiram says, okay, I'll give the cities back to you. And that would be recorded in 2 Chronicles 8:2. Hiram gave the cities back to Solomon. So in 1 Kings 9:11, Solomon gave the cities to Hiram as security after the debt was paid back by Solomon, 2 Chronicles 8:2. Then Hiram gave the security, the cities, back to Solomon. Well, another way to solve this problem is to say that Solomon gave the cities to Hiram, 1 Kings 9:11. Hiram refused the cities because he didn't like them. So in 2 Chronicles 8:2, Hiram gives the cities back to Solomon, says, I don't want these things. So Solomon took them back and rebuilt them. I think option number one is better, because I can't believe a king would just, I don't like these cities, I'll give them back. I mean, he might not like them, but they're worth something just to give them back. No, I think they were security for the loan. And so they passed in two directions. When Solomon was a debtor, he passed the cities to Hiram as security. Then when Solomon was no longer a debtor and he paid off the loan, the cities came back to him. And then Solomon settled the cities with Israelites. Now this gold that Solomon had gotten from Hiram in verse 11 is, as Gill says, quote, not before mentioned, and accounts for it from whence Solomon had his gold, if he made no use, as some think he did not, of what his father left him. He quotes 1 Kings 7:51, which we talked about in several podcasts previous. There's a big debate on whether David laid up some gold and silver in preparations for building the temple, but he didn't get to use them. And then Gil built the temple. The question is, did he use some of that laid up gold that David had laid up, or did he just start from scratch and just put David's gold in a treasury? We talked about that. I don't know what the answer is, but at any rate, Solomon had plenty of gold from Hiram to build the temple, even without his father David's gold. Now, where did Hiram get all this gold? Probably from trading with Ophir, as we'll see in just at the end of this chapter. Ophir was noted for having gold, whereas Ophir, O-P-H-I-R, Ophir, or Ophir, Ophir, it was either in southern Arabia somewhere, maybe in Yemen, southwestern Saudi Arabia, maybe on the African coast of the Red Sea. Who knows? Nobody knows to this day, but it was noted for having gold. Now, this gold, as I said, was probably a loan to Solomon. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown mentioned that some people think that Solomon had won the gold from Hiram in a game of chance, or in games of chance. Let me read this, quote, the gold, however, as others think, may have been the amount of forfeits paid to Solomon by Hiram for not being able to answer the riddles and apophthegms with which, according to Josephus, in their private correspondence, the two sovereigns amused themselves. Please. I love these speculations that are off the wall. Hiram got himself in debt because he couldn't answer Solomon's riddles, and so that's where Solomon got the gold to build the temple. No. Now, in verse 12, when it says that Solomon was not pleased with the towns that were given to him by Solomon, John Gill says that doesn't mean that Hiram was contemptuous of Solomon. It just means that the villages were unsuitable to him. And it might be they were unsuitable to him because he was a maritime guy, and those cities were not suited to maritime enterprises. They might have been valuable to other people. Solomon might have thought, well, these are valuable cities, I'll give them to Hiram. But Hiram says, oh, well, you know, that's not going to really suit me. As Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, the city's inland situation made them unsuitable to Hiram's maritime and commercial enterprises. So that's probably all it means, is he didn't like them because they didn't fit him. But that doesn't mean that they were villages of hovels. They were probably strong agricultural towns. Hiram would never have dissed such a close friend and ally, and not to mention the fact, if that gold was a loan, he probably was assuaged about the poor quality of the towns when Solomon paid him back. Now this 120 talents of gold that traveled from Hiram to Solomon, that doesn't sound like much to our Western ears, but the Holman Christian Study Bible, which translation likes to put English units in place of the Greek unit, or not the Greek, but the Hebrew units, says that 120 talents is 9,000 pounds. 9,000 pounds of gold, folks, that's a lot of gold. Now, gold is very, very heavy, but Remember, the interior of Solomon's temple was covered with gold. Everything was gold. The tables, the walls, the ark, the cherubim, everything gold. Now, all of this discussion in which I said that this gold was probably a loan, that it was a loan, is agreed to by Adam Clark. He says this, quote, "This was the sum which Hiram had lent, and in order to pay this, Solomon had laid a tax upon his people, as we afterward learned. The whole is very darkly expressed." Well, that is right. It's not expressed very clearly, but I think that's what happened. We go down to 1 Kings 9, verses 15 through 19. Here is the account of the forced labor King Solomon conscripted to build the Lord's temple, his own palace, the supporting terraces, the wall of Jerusalem, and Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. So now we go get into Solomon's construction. Verse 16, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, had attacked and captured Gezer. He had set it on fire. He killed its Canaanite inhabitants and then gave it as a wedding gift to his daughter, Solomon's wife. And Solomon rebuilt Gezer. He built up, Solomon built up Lor Beth Horon, Baalath, and Tadmor in the desert within his land, as well as all his store cities and the towns for his chariots and for his horses. Whatever he desired to build in Jerusalem and Lebanon and throughout all the territory he ruled. Now in verse 15, the text says, here is the account of the forced labor. The King James says, here is the reason for the levy. On account of why does King Solomon have forced labor, to put it roughly? One of my commentators, Adam Clark, says this, quote, "In order to pay Hiram the 60 talents of gold, 120 talents of gold, which he had borrowed from him, Hiram, not being willing to take the Galilean cities mentioned above, or having taken them, soon restored them again, Solomon was obliged to lay a tax upon the people, and that this was a grievous and oppressive tax we learn from 1 Kings 12, verses 1 through 4, where the elders of Israel came to Rehoboam, complaining of their heavy state of taxation and entreating that their yoke might be made lighter." Clark quotes 1 Kings 12, 1 through 4. I'll read you verse 4 of 1 Kings 12. "Your," that would be Rehoboam's father, that would be Solomon, "your father Solomon," these are Jeroboam's people talking to Rehoboam, and they said, "Look, your father Solomon made our yoke difficult. You therefore lighten your father's harsh service and the heavy yoke he put on us, and we will serve you." See, this is what I love about reading ancient history. They always talk about the beautiful monuments and the tombs and the hanging gardens and the temples and the palaces, and all the tourists go look at them and go, ooh and ah, and oh, look at that pyramid. They never mention the Great Wall of China. They never mention the poor suckers that were slaves that had to build those things. And they never mention all the high taxes that ground down the people in order to pay for those things. I mean, I love ancient cathedrals, and I love looking at all these monuments of the ancient world because I love history. But every time I look at them, I think, thank God I didn't have to pay for that. And we see here that Solomon was a member of a certain political party that likes to spend money, except both of them do, except one of them more than the other. Spend the money on government things and then tax the people for it or inflate the currency. Well, let's look at some of the places that Solomon built with his forced labor that he conscripted. Well, we mentioned the temple and his palace, of course. We've already done that. And then the supporting terraces, that's the Millo. Supporting terraces is the Holman Christian Study Bible translation. People don't know exactly what that Millo is. It was some kind of wall right at the north of the city of David, Mount Zion. And right north of that wall was Mount Moriah, north and maybe northwest a little bit. And the wall was a defense against people coming from the south into the temple area. So he built that. As we're going to see here, all the places he built are strategic militarily. He built the wall of Jerusalem, which of course protected Jerusalem. Now Hazor is a town, in Naphtali, or Naphtali. I don't know how, I think it's Naphtali the way most people pronounce it. And that is the tribe that runs on the western side of the Sea of Galilee and Lake Hula, Lake Hula being to the north of the Sea of Galilee, and Hazor is right southwest of the tip of Lake Hula. Now Hazor translated means enclosed or fortified. Easton says it was a stronghold of the Canaanites in the mountains north of Lake Merom, Lake Hula, but actually the map has it to the south, we'll go with a more modern map. Easton's is an old commentary. They're kind of weak on geography. They didn't have Google Earth back then. Now, Hazar, you might remember, because of the story of Barak and Deborah in Judges, Jabin the king with his allied tribes here encountered Joshua. Well, this is, I'm sorry, even before the Judges, Joshua fought a big battle there at Hazar. Joshua gained a signal victory, which virtually completed his conquest of Canaan. The city was, however, afterwards rebuilt by the Canaanites and was ruled by a king with the same hereditary name of Jabin. Now, this king, this new king Jabin, his army under a noted leader of the name of Sisera, the guy who got the temple stake driven through his head by in the story, this army under Jabin swept down upon the south, aiming at the complete subjugation of the country. This powerful army was met by the Israelites under Barak, who went forth by the advice of the prophetess Deborah. The result was one of the most remarkable victories for Israel recorded in the Old Testament. We've already gone over that in Joshua. It's a great story. So after that battle, the city of Hazar was taken, occupied by the Israelites, and Solomon here fortifies it. And he fortified it to defend the entrance into the kingdom from Syria and Assyria. Once again, this is a strategic place. When Tiglath-Pileser, the Assyrian king, invaded the land, this was one of the first cities he captured, Hazor. So we need to remember Hazor, strategic. Solomon also fortified Megiddo in verse 15. Now, Megiddo is famous. Of course, that's where Armageddon's supposed to take place. I don't believe that because I believe that is a misreading of the term Armageddon in the book of Revelation, which is very complicated. I won't go into that now, but it's famous because of that. It's in the tribe of Manasseh. It means place of troops. As Easton's, this is Easton's. It was originally Megiddo, one of the royal cities of the Canaanites. It does not seem to have been fully occupied by the Israelites till the time of Solomon, which is where we are now. The valley or plain of Megiddo was part of the plain of Esdraelon, the great battlefield of Palestine. Now, I've been to Megiddo. I've stood there and looked out over the plain of Esdraelon or the plain of Megiddo. I don't know how you distinguish those two. And I mean, you can see as far as your eyeballs will take your eyesight. You can see forever. And you look down there and you see a car driving by. It looks like an ant. And of course, Megiddo, the plain of Megiddo or the Esdraelon Valley, it runs from Haifa, Mount Carmel in the northwest. It goes southeast till it basically opens out into the Jordan Valley. The king of Hazor that I just mentioned was beaten there in that valley. Another famous incident happened there. 609 BC, Pharaoh Necho marched against the king of Assyria. He didn't have a fight to pick with Israel, but Joshua decided he's got to go stop him. And he got killed there. Joshua got beat. So lots of interesting things happened at Megiddo. And it was a prime place for a military position there. If I remember correctly, there's archaeology there. You can walk up and see the fort there, right there at the top of the hill there, with Megiddo. American Heritage Dictionary says Megiddo is, quote, the scene of many battles throughout early history because of its strategic position on the route connecting Egypt with Mesopotamia. So Megiddo is a strategic place because it stops Egypt. They have to come up the Egyptian road there, the I forgot what they called it. Is that the King's Highway? Not the King's Highway. It's the coast road that runs up from Egypt right along the Mediterranean coast. When they get right up there to Mount Carmel, present-day Haifa, then they march into that valley, go through the valley, hit the Jordan Valley, cross the Jordan River, and then go on up to Syria and on into Mesopotamia. So that was a very strategic place. Solomon fortified it. The next place he fortified was in verse 15, Gezer. Now, Gezer is in the tribe of Ephraim. I'm going to locate it for you. First of all, it's about 5 miles north of the Valley of Sorek, and that's where Samson did all of his activities. The east end of the Valley of Sorek is Zorah, where Samson was born, where I think he was buried there too. Well, Zorah and Eshtaol, those two towns, he was either born or buried, I can't remember which, but that's where he was from, his home stomping grounds. As you go a little bit west in the Valley of Sorek, you get to the town of Timnah. Remember the Timnite woman that Solomon married? Then you go from a little bit further west in the Valley of Sorek, you see Ekron, one of the famous five Philistine cities. So that's all to the south of Gezer. And to the east of Gezer is Ajalon, where the sun stood and the moon stood still. And if you go a little bit to the northeast of Gezer, you hit Beth Horon, which is the pass through which Joshua came to then turn south and finish his southern campaign to conquer all of Israel from the Canaanites. So Gezer was a strategic place. It protected from the Philistines on the west. Solomon built it. Gezer was mentioned also in 2 Samuel 5 as the last point to which David pursued the Philistines after the Battle of Baal-Perazim, which I'm sure you don't remember, but I hardly remember it myself. I vaguely remember it, but I remember that David chased the Philistines all the way up there to Gezer. And of course, our text here says the king of Egypt took it and gave it to Solomon. The Canaanites kept possession of Gezer all the way up until the time of Solomon, and the Pharaoh of Egypt gave it to Solomon as a wedding present, or maybe as part of the dowry. Doesn't really say. Gill says it wasn't a dowry. It was a present after she was married. It doesn't matter. The king of Egypt gave it to Solomon. Nice little alliance there. Marriage alliance. My daughter is married to you. One more town is mentioned that Solomon fortified. Baalath in verse 18. If you look at the map, Gezer I just told you about, which is kind of to the west of Beth Horon, and to the north of the valley of Sorek, Samson's old valley. Well, if you go due west of Gezer about 8 miles or so, you hit Baalath, which is at the head of the valley of Sorek. That, of course, is strategic too, because Philistines are going to probably be coming down through that valley. Now, another place called Tadmor is built by Solomon in verse 18. Tadmor translated means palm, or in the wilderness, palm in the wilderness. Now, that name Palm is reflected in its modern name of Palmyra. Now, Palmyra is famous in ancient history. And I remember in 2015 when those ISIS SOBs, these Muslim terrorists, attacked it and started destroying monuments. And I just didn't even want to look. And so I haven't looked at Palmyra since then. This is 2022, so this is 7 years later. And I looked it up on Wikipedia. And it turns out that the damage was not as quite as bad as I had originally thought, as everybody had originally thought. So there's still a lot of ruins there. So this is an interesting place. It's right as you go northeast of Israel, heading toward Damascus, right there in the Syrian desert. I'm going to read Easton's description of it. It is called Palmyra by the Greeks and Romans. It stood in the great Syrian wilderness, 176 miles from Damascus. That would be south and west of Damascus, and 130 miles from the Mediterranean. I guess the Mediterranean would be due west. It's out in the desert, basically. It was the center of a vast commercial traffic with Western Asia. It was also an important military station. Remains of ancient temples and palaces surrounded by splendid colonnades of white marble, many of which are yet standing, and thousands of prostrate pillars scattered over a large extent of space, attest the ancient magnificence of the city of palms, surpassing that of the renowned cities of Greece and Rome. Now, that might sound a little grandiloquent, but I'm telling you, if you look at images, do a search on Palmyra images, and you will see this is a place I want to go see. Of course, I don't want to get killed going into Syria, but boy, I'd like to go see that city or those ancient ruins. It's right in the middle of the desert, so there's deserts everywhere, and all of a sudden, right out of the desert, all these beautiful temples, and a lot of them. But at any rate, that would be a strategic place, too, anybody attacking. Remember, anybody that attacked Israel always came from the north, but really what that means is from the northeast. They would come up the Mesopotamian Valley, and then they'd bend on down and hit Israel from the north. Well, Tadmor, or Palmyra, Tadmor, would be a nice place to have in order to stop such an expedition against Israel. We go down to 1 Kings 9, verses 20 through 25. All the people left from the Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, these people were not Israelites, well, obviously, that is their descendants remaining in the land, and I'm not going to go through all the seven Canaanite nations, I've done that so many times in previous audios, their descendants remaining in the land whom the Israelites could not exterminate, these Solomon conscripted for his slave labor force. So that's where the slaves came from, as it is to this day, the day that the book was written, probably by Jeremiah, and probably in the 6th century B.C. But Solomon did not make slaves of any of the Israelites. They were his fighting men, his government officials, his officers, his captains, and the commanders of his chariots and charioteers. They were also the chief officials in charge of Solomon's projects, 550 officials supervising the men who did the work. After Pharaoh's daughter had come up from the city of David to the palace Solomon had built for her, he constructed the supporting terraces. That would be the millo, the wall, or whatever it was. People are not really sure what it was, but the wall that was at the southern end of Mount Moriah, the northern end of the city of David, Mount Zion. 3 times a year, Solomon sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings on the altar. That's peace offerings. On the altar he had built for the Lord, burning incense before the Lord along with them, and so fulfilled the temple obligations. Now all these remaining ites, the Canaanites, Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, etc., they were the posterity of those that were left unsubdued in the times of Joshua. And of course, the Israelites were supposed to have taken care of them by now, but they didn't. And so they're still around. Solomon made them slaves, but he didn't make the Israelites slaves. He states in verse, it is stated in verse 22, it would be illegal to make them slaves. Leviticus 25:39 says this, and if a countryman of yours becomes so poor with regard to you that he sells himself to you, you shall not subject him to a slave's service. Now, I need to explain that a little further. Of course, Israelites could become slaves to other Israelites for 7 years, after which they could either become permanent slaves with all to the ear, or they were released. But this is talking about a slave service that you couldn't subject to Hebrew to. This is, it's talking about severe service. This is what John Gill says, quote, bondmen were put to the hardest service, the greatest drudgery, as well as what was mean and reproachful, and were used in the most rigorous and despotic manner, and were obliged to serve forever and were never released. So you could imagine building all these cities was drudgery, hardest service, reproachful, and that's the kind of stuff that Israelites were not supposed to be a part of, according to this law in Leviticus. Now, in verse 23, the text states that there were 550 officials supervising all of this work that we've been talking about, and we immediately have a reconciliation problem. 2 Chronicles 8:10, these were King Solomon's deputies, 250 who ruled over the people, and that 2 Chronicles 8:10 is the parallel passage from what we're reading here in 1 Kings 9. So here's some options to reconcile those two numbers. Remember, 550 in Kings, 250 in Chronicles. Option number one, this is from John Gill. The top and middlemost supervisors together make 550. Now, Gill quotes the rabbis, the Jewish rabbis. He says that the rabbis said there were three sorts of rulers. You got the lowest rank, 3,300. The middle rank of supervisors over those 3,300 is consisted of 300, which were over the 3,300. That made 3,600, and that number 3,600 is given in 2 Chronicles 2:18, and then the highest rank over the middle rank was 250. So if the middle rank had 300, the highest rank had 250, you put them together, and then you get 550. There's only one little problem with that. It never says anywhere that I can see that the middle rank consisted of 300 supervisors. And so I always take these Jewish rabbis with a grain of salt. Benson has another reconciliation. He says that the 250 mentioned in Chronicles worked over the temple only. The other 300 worked over public works. That's a simple reconciliation. Poole, the commentator, says that the 250 in Chronicles were Israelites. The other 300 were foreigners. I think that's a stretch. Here's another good one that's a stretch. I say good, I mean good in the sense of creative, not likely. This is from Poole again. 250 supervisors were rotated out with another 250 as they worked their shifts. That made a total of 500. Then there was 50 left over that were either supervisory over the 250 or they were a reserve. Well, that's speculation upon speculation. The easiest way is what Benson says. 250 supervisors worked over the temple. The other 300 worked over the public works. Chronicles would be more interested in the temple anyway. That's the two priestly histories, more interested in the temple than they are in the politics, as Kings was. Now, in verse 24, we read that Pharaoh's daughter had come up from the city of David to the palace that Solomon had built for her. Remember, the city of David is that long tongue of land that stretches from Mount Moriah down in the midst of three valleys, to the west, Tarapean Valley, to the east, the Kidron Valley, the very south, the Valley of Hinnom. And so Pharaoh's daughter, Solomon's wife, she was staying in the city of David, and she just went a short distance up, past the Millo, up onto Mount Moriah, because the palace is up there near the temple somewhere, and she was there. Now, the next question that arises is why did Solomon move his wife from the city of David? Well, we can discover the answer to that by looking at the parallel passage in 2 Chronicles 8:11. Solomon brought the daughter of Pharaoh from the city of David to the house he had built for her. For he said, my wife must not live in the house of David, king of Israel, because the places the ark of the Lord has come into are holy. So apparently what happened is when David brought the ark from Kiriath-Jearim into Jerusalem, he put it near where he was living when he built that special tent for it. And so Pharaoh's daughter, who was a foreigner and not clean, she was an Egyptian woman, not to mention the fact that every month she would be unclean, but I think that's a stretch. Basically, she was a foreigner, and Solomon didn't want to put a foreigner near where the ark had been. Well, he says right here in 2 Chronicles, last part of verse 11, chapter 8, verse 11, "My wife must not live at the house of David, because the places the ark of the Lord has come into are holy." So David's house was holy, but his wife was not. The mention of the supporting terraces right here in the context of the movement of Pharaoh's daughter makes people think that the Pharaoh's daughter's palace was nearby. And of course, that was near Solomon's. That was in Solomon's palace complex, which, if my memory serves me correctly, has been lost. They don't know exactly where that temple is, so we have to speculate. Now, verse 25, three times a year Solomon sacrificed burnt offerings and peace offerings. Those three times a year, of course, were the three famous feasts, Passover in the spring, Pentecost in the early summer, Tabernacles in the fall. In fact, in our parallel passage, it says that explicitly, 2 Chronicles 8:13, according to the commandment of Moses, the sacrifice was given, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Weeks. The Feast of Unleavened Bread is Passover. Feast of Weeks is the Harvest Festival, Pentecost. And the Feast of Booths is the Feast of Tabernacles. Also in that verse is mentioned the other sacrifices that were given for the Sabbaths and the new moons also. Now, when it says that Solomon sacrificed in verse 25, it doesn't mean he did it personally. He had his priest do it. Solomon couldn't legally sacrifice because he was a king. He was not a priest. In verse 25, it says that Solomon burnt incense on the altar. That would be the golden altar of incense at the western end of the holy place. Now, again, that was probably by one of his priests because a king couldn't do that. Remember Uzziah later on in the monarchy? He went into the holy place, offered incense on the golden altar, and was struck with leprosy. 2 Chronicles 26:16, "But when he, Uzziah, became strong, he grew arrogant, and it led to his own destruction." Well, Solomon was not going to do that, so I'm sure it was priests doing this for him. We go now to verses 26 through 28, and we finish this chapter. "King Solomon also built ships at Ezion-Geber, which is near Eilat in Edom, on the shore of the Red Sea. And Hiram sent his men, sailors who knew the sea, to serve in the fleet with Solomon's men. They sailed to Ophir and brought back 420 talents of gold, which they delivered to King Solomon." Verse 26, Solomon built ships at Ezion-Geber, that is either at Eilat or near Eilat. Eilat is at the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba. If you look at a modern map of Israel, you see the southern border of Israel comes down to a point. So Ezion-Geber is the ancient name for the place. Let me tell you about Eilat, because it's a modern place. It's still there. In fact, I've been there. I spent the night there one night. And, well, let me read. This is from reference.com, coming from the Columbia Electronic Encyclopedia. Eilat, southern Israel, a port on the Gulf of Aqaba, an arm of the Red Sea. It's the arm of the Red Sea that forms the eastern half of Mount Sinai Peninsula, the other part of the of the Sinai Peninsula. The other side of the Sinai Peninsula is the Gulf of Suez, and those two branches branch out, those two arms branch out from the Red Sea proper. So Eilat is a port there. It is strategically located near the Sinai Peninsula, Jordan. If you go just a hop, skip, and a jump, you're over in Jordan, because I did that. You just get on the road and drive just a couple of hundred feet, and you're in Jordan. They have a town over there called Aqaba, and Eilat, they're kind of like sister cities right there at that point on the northern tip of the Gulf of Aqaba. And Saudi Arabia, of course, if you go just a little bit south down the coast, well, if you go down the eastern coast of the Gulf of Aqaba, you're on the Mount Sinai Peninsula. The western coast, I'm sorry. If you go down the eastern coast of the Gulf of Aqaba, you're in Saudi Arabia. And the border of Jordan butts into Saudi Arabia right around that area somewhere. Eilat is Israel's gateway to Africa and East Asia. It has some light industry, but is known more as a tourist center. Notice Israel's gateway to Africa and East Asia, trade, because that's what Solomon's going to use this place for, trade to the whole world. It has fine beaches, hotels, and an airport. The city is the terminus of an oil pipeline to Haifa. Eilat was perhaps identical with or near Ezion Geber. The BibleAtlas.org map has it, Ezion Geber, a little bit down the Sinai Peninsula side of it, coast of the Gulf of Aqaba, just a hop, skip, and a jump from Eilat. But as far as I'm concerned, it's basically the same place. It was a port in Solomon's time. It was rebuilt by King Uzziah of Judah, lost to the Syrians in the 8th century B.C. King Ahaz did that. Eilat was resettled in 1949. That would be by the Israelites. Its deep water harbor was opened in 1965. So this is a famous place. I'll tell you a little war story. I went to bed there thinking, oh, what a cool vacation place this is. Woke up the next day. Our tour guide was driving a car that he drove us around in. He had gone somewhere else to spend the night. My wife and I get out. We go to the street to wait for our tour guide. I look up at the street, and I see this jagged vapor trail all over the place in the sky. Then I see a destroyer, an Israeli destroyer, right there in the Gulf of Aqaba. I ask the tour guide, what's going on here? He says, oh, nothing serious. An Egyptian terrorist had got a shoulder-fired surface-to-air missile, and he stood over there on the Mount Sinai side of the Gulf of Aqaba, which belonged to Egypt, and he fired it into Eilat, but the missile misfired and didn't do any damage in the city. And I thought to myself, well, isn't that convenient? Because I was in the city sleeping peacefully. And then I said, well, what is all the jagged vapor trail up there for? He said, oh, that's the way the missile misfired. It went all over the sky. It went crazy up there. And I said, and I suppose that's what the Israeli destroyer is there for. He said, oh, yeah, the military called the ship in. I said, let's get out of here. And we did. Now, let me read you what reference.com from the Columbia Electronic Encyclopedia says about Ezion Geber. It was an ancient port on the Gulf of Aqaba. The site near Aqaba is now some distance from the shore, which is advancing. The Bible reveals the existence of a port there from the reign of Solomon to at least that of Uzziah. Excavations were carried out 1938 through 1940 under American auspices. The largest copper refineries ever found to have existed in the ancient world were unearthed at the level of the oldest of the five periods of settlement. Trade relations existed with Phoenicia, Arabia, Egypt, Sinai, and Greece. Well, if trade relations existed with Phoenicia, that means that somebody had to take a ship, go out of the Gulf of Aqaba, south into the Indian Ocean, and then all the way around Africa, all the way back up the western coast of Africa to go back into the Mediterranean Sea at the Rock of Gibraltar and to get back to Phoenicia. So I guess it was possible back then, which I find amazing in Western history. I think it was a big deal to do that. I forgot which explorer did that for the first time. Got around Africa, and everybody says, woo, wonderful, wonderful. Well, this is back in the 5th century B.C. Apparently people were doing that. But anyway, Eilat and Ezion Geber, a big deal. Ezion Geber, by the way, means giant's backbone. John Gill says, quote, the ridge of rocks before this port were in that form, the form of a giant's backbone. The rocks were covered by sea at high water and sticking up with various points on a line when the tide was low. Now, in verse 27, it says, and Hiram sent his men, sailors who knew the sea, to serve in the fleet with Solomon's men. Now, that would be very simple to explain if we didn't have the parallel passage in 2 Chronicles 8:18. So Hiram sent ships to him by his servants along with the crews of experienced seamen. Ships were added along with seamen. They went, Hiram's seamen, went with Solomon's servants to Ophir. Well, so here's the problem. In 2 Chronicles 8:18, how did Hiram get his ships to Eilat, to Ezion Geber? How did he do that? If you'll look at the map, or think about the map, you go north from Eilat to get into Israel proper, go over to the Mediterranean coast, and keep going up till you get to Tyre. There's no waterway between Tyre and Eilat. How did Hiram get ships there? I've actually got five options to solve this, because this is, again, not one of those problems that is going to advance your sanctification, but it's interesting from an historical point of view. Here's the first option. Somewhere there's a branch of the Nile that flows into the Red Sea, and so then Hiram could take his ships down to where the Nile flows into the Mediterranean Sea, go down the Nile, and then cut east over into the Red Sea, and then you can get up to Aqaba. Well, Gil didn't have the advantage of Google Earth. He didn't have the use of Google Earth, and he was writing in the 1700s, so he was relying on travelers and geographers, and they didn't know what they were talking about, so that's not an option. So here's another option. Hiram dragged his ships from the Mediterranean shore across the desert to Eilat. Now, Ellicott denies that that happened. The Cambridge commentary says, well, that's a difficult but not impossible task. Dragging ship? I don't think so. That's not a good option. Here's another option. Hiram's ships coming out of Tyre went west through the Mediterranean Sea, through the Rock of Gibraltar, south along the western coast of Africa, around Africa, back up, and then, of course, you just sail up the Red Sea to Aqaba. Well, as I just said, I was kind of surprised to think that ships could sail around Africa in the ancient world. I'm not dead sure of that now. I'm just speculating. The pulpit commentary said that Hiram's ships from previous sailing expeditions were already located there at Eilat, or Ezion-Geber, and so Hiram's sailors came down there and manned those ships and then joined up with Solomon to build ships and to sail ships. So the pulpit commentary thinks it's possible. John Gill says this, perhaps as some commentator named Gussetins conjectures, Hiram had a port in the Red Sea for building and sending out ships for the sake of his eastern navigation, and from thence he sent them to Solomon's ports in the same sea. In other words, Hiram had a port near Ezion-Geber, and his ships were there, and he just sent his sailors from Tyre down to Eilat, and then he operated from there. Well, that's not unreasonable. Fourth option to solve this problem, Ellicott says that Hiram's ships were docked at Yaffa, which is, of course, on the Israeli coast, Mediterranean coast. The ships stayed there, then the sailors continued overland, and they went down to Eilat, to Ezion-Geber. And while Hiram's ships were docked at Yaffa, the Jewish shipwrights carefully studied those ships, and then they took the knowledge back down to Eilat where they built the ships. Well, that's reasonable. Barnes also has that solution. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says that when 2 Chronicles 8:18 says that Hiram sent ships, that what the Hebrew word there means is supplied. He supplied ships by his servants, and so Hiram's men went down to Eilat and built the ships for the Jews at Eilat. And so the ships themselves were not built anywhere else but at Eilat, so they didn't have to go across the desert or across some secret passage waterway from the Nile River. Or they didn't even have to go down to Yaffa from Tyre. Well, in my uneducated, humble opinion, I think Ellicott and Barnes have probably got the best idea. The ships went down to Yaffa, then the sailors continued overland. Jameson Fawcett and Brown has a very similar solution. There's no ships going to Yaffa, but the sailors went from Tyre to Eilat, and then they built the ships down there. I think that's the best way to do it. If you read 2 Chronicles 8:18, you can read it that way. So Hiram sent ships to Solomon by his servants. In other words, through the agency of his servants, ships were sent to Hiram. It doesn't necessarily mean that the ships were sent from Hiram. It meant through the agency of his servants, ships were sent. So that's how we're going to solve that little problem. John Gill says that Tyre had the first navy in recorded history. Quote, "The invention of ships of burden, or merchant ships, such as these were, is by Pliny, the ancient Roman writer, ascribed to Hippus the Tyrian." Interesting little factoid. Now, verse 28, and we'll be finished. They, these are Hiram's and Solomon's men who are serving in Solomon's ships, they sailed to Ophir and brought back 420 talents of gold, which they delivered to King Solomon. Now, as I said earlier, Ophir, the place is not known where it is. Here's what Columbia Electronic Encyclopedia says. Ophir is a, quote, seaport or region from which the ships of Solomon brought fine gold in great quantity. And quantity, let's stop and mention that. 420 talents of gold, 120 talents of gold, Holman Christian Study Bible said was 9,000 pounds. 420 talents, that's a lot of gold. But not only gold, the Columbia Electronic Encyclopedia continues, but sandalwood, precious stones, ivory, apes, and peacocks were also part of the triennial cargo. Cargo came back once every 3 years, but it was loaded. The location of Ophir is unknown. It has been variously identified with Northeast Africa, Southeast Arabia. Northeast Africa would be somewhere on the Egyptian coastline, or the Sudanese coastline, perhaps. Southeast Arabia, that would be Yemen. Southeast Arabia, that's the United Arab Republics, I think, where that is now. India, which is, you go out the Gulf of Aqaba and have to go further east until you hit India. But the present tendency is to identify it with Southwest Arabia, the modern Yemen. and possibly the neighboring African coast. Well, that's what I always think. I think Fearless Yemen, that's probably where it is. It's somewhere down there. There's a lot of gold there. Ladies and gentlemen, with that difficult chapter, we are now finished. And we're now prepared to go to 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 1 through 29, the Queen of Sheba, talking about Solomon's wisdom, and we'll also talk about Solomon's wealth. We already mentioned some of it already, and we're going to mention it some more. Hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.